everyone. Welcome to At the Devil's Ball, the podcast where we talk about horror films in a positive and constructive manner. I am Nathaniel, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Samuel Numene. Sam, how you doing?
Doing well.
Doing great. We have a very special guest with us this week before we do the vital stats. We have a comedy producer. He's perhaps most well-known now for The Mads with Trace Beaulieu and Frank Conniff, movie riffing show. They do a live show every month. He produces that. Chris, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Great. Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for taking the time.
Yeah.
Of course. Yeah.
The funny thing is I had messaged you. We were planning in September for me to take a few shots with people that I saw as, quote, celebrities. Mm-hmm. You were surprised me being like, oh, I could do that well before. And I was like, I thought like 3 months in advance.
I mean, even like Trace and Frank, anytime we try to get them booked on podcasts, it's like people are expecting that like a little bit, but it's always like, yeah, they can do tomorrow at 3 p.m. That's fine.
Yeah. Oh, that's very cool. But I mean, it was funny because you had said that, and I said, and I want to tell the story a little bit because it puts Sam in a positive light too. But I asked you, I was like, what would you like to do then? And you said your first thing was Friday the 13th. You said, I love Friday the 13th, even the bad ones, which made me immediately be like, you're perfect for the show.
Yes. Right.
Because we that's like our mantra is we love horror movies, even when they're not good. But I texted Sam and be like, so Chris Kurzweil's ready to go like next week. And he wants to do we're going to do Friday the 13th. And Sam says, is that what he wants to do? because apparently Sam thinks I strong arm people, because our theme this month is unhappy campers. We're doing summer camp horror films. And so he's like, is that what he wants to do? And I'm like, yeah, of
course. Well, it was the way you worded it was like it's not could have been like you told him he was coming on to do this. I'm like, can we see what he wants to do? I'll do whatever.
Apparently Sam thinks that I just tell people like, this is what we're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, he bullies me all the time, so I just assume he does to everybody.
Before I said Friday the 13th, I think I just looked back at what other movies you guys have done, and I saw you did like most of the Nightmare on Elm Street and Halloween's, but not the Friday the 13th. So that was probably like, that was just me being like, hey, I'd love to be a part of your Friday the 13th series. So.
Well, we've talked about doing it. We've never gotten around to it, and so when you said that, I was like, well, that. Not only is the unhappy campers thing perfect, but you know, it's something we've wanted to talk about. It's a really fun movie. So Sam, why don't you do the vital stats?
All right, so obviously we're talking about Friday 13th, the final chapter. It came out April 13th, 1984. Had a budget of about $2.6 million, made about $33 million. 1.85:1 ratio, kind of standard for slasher movies of the time. Directed by Joe Zito, who also did Missing in Action, The Prowler, my favorite Chuck Norris movie, Invasion USA. Written by Barney Cohen, who I guess created Forever Night, did Killer Party and Stunts.
Forever Night with a K?
Yes, the TV show. Cusso Jr., of course, producing. Best known for all the Friday the 13th films, but we also did April Fool's Day, which he produced.
Oh yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, got. I'm gonna screw up the name, but Jao Fernandez was the cinematographer, also from Invasion USA and The Prowler. Joel Goodman did Missing in Action, Invasion USA, The Prowler. There's a lot of canon DNA in these these credits.
Yeah.
And of course, we have the great Tom Savini doing kind of a victory lap with this one. On the special effects, Kevin Yeager, who designed The Crypt Keeper, worked on Nightmare on Elm Street 2, and John Vulich, who did special effects creation for Buffy and Babylon 5, worked on this.
Oh, wow.
And the Tom Savini's team. Music, of course, Harry Manfredini again. Also did Wishmaster, the House series.
Did he do the music for all the Friday the 13th?
All of them up through like the final Friday, I know for sure.
I don't think he did
the ones after that. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, it seems like, I mean, they kind of moved away from like the more like Hitchcock
yeah,
orchestral score by then.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. We've got my second favorite Jason, Ted White, just stunt performer extraordinaire. He's actually did stuff up until like the mid 2000s. He was in Tokyo Drift as a stunt person. He was also in, of course, you know, the best movie ever made, Roadhouse. And he was a stunt performer on Creature from the Black Lagoon, which I did not know.
I like when stunt performers become sort of, you know, famous, even if they don't have any lines.
Yeah,
you know, like a Darth Maul type. Like, there hasn't been really anyone since.
Right, right.
But yeah, no, I like that. And like Kane, you know, like Kane Hodder is like most known for playing. He's like the most well-known Jason, I think, despite he didn't come on to like 6 or 7 or something, right?
It was 7.
Seven.
Yep. So I think it was CJ Graham in part 6, but I could be misremembering it. But yeah, 7, and he's like, you know, the Jason. But outside of obviously him, I feel like, you know, Ted White actually has the.
When we get there, I want to talk about. Yeah. I actually think Ted White's actually the best, but
right,
I think he's better than Hodder is. But.
And as far as cast, of course, we have Corey Feldman in an early role, not his first, but an early one. Joan Freeman plays Mrs. Jarvis. Kimberly Beck plays Trish. Peter Barton plays Doug. Judy Aronson plays Samantha. Eric Anderson, who I always think is like a young Robert Urich, plays Rob, the guy who is hunting Jason.
Yes, the like proto Tommy Jarvis.
Yeah, they almost his mentor. If they would have had one more scene, you know, could have been like a mentor kind of thing. Totally. And some guy, and I'm going to mess up this name, Crispin Glover.
Never heard of him.
Heard of this guy?
Yeah, never heard of him.
He apparently is a dead fuck. That's all I found out on the same. Of course, Crispin Glover is Jimmy. We all know and love Crispin's.
Yeah, like a year and a year performances. A year before, you know, Back to the Future. So he was completely unknown in this.
He was a little known. He's been in a couple of films, and like there was a TV show that he did with like a short-lived TV show he did with Nicolas Cage, whose name I can't remember.
Wow. Yeah.
But yeah, this is kind of where he started to come into the public consciousness, I think. Mm-hmm. And that does it for the main cast. Did I miss anybody important? I mean, who's important in these films? It's always the hardest part to figure.
Well, I mean, one of the things that I think is very important in this movie is that it has a decoy final girl, Sarah, who I think deserves better. That's my mantra. She should have been the hero of the movie. I liked her better than Trish.
Right.
But she's
I don't know if I look. You liked her more than Trish? I mean, I liked her, but I think Trish is cooler at the end of the day.
Well, I mean, Sarah obviously was not a survivor. You know, I mean, she wasn't going to do well. But I mean, I just liked the character. I was just like, I like Sarah.
Oh, I agree.
She's a nice girl. You know, I think out of all of them, I'd want to meet Sarah the most. But
so Chris, why did you kind of pick this one to come on and do?
So. I don't know. I feel like I probably didn't watch this one until like I remember seeing the original Friday the 13th when I was like 13 or so. Mm-hmm. But then I think I probably watched them like all out of order. So, you know, this going back after seeing them all and then like kind of revisiting them all, this one really to me felt like kind of the quintessential just Jason stalking people in the woods movie, you know, before like he becomes more of like a zombie that's like being resurrected in every movie. And it like, to me, this is just like the classic like template for Jason in the woods, you know, stalking people. And also cause he's got the hockey, like the movie starts, he's already like the Jason that we know and love. It's not, there's no like lead up to it. Like if I was going to pick one Jason movie to like show to someone who's like, I just want to see like Jason, like I would pick this one. And I also like that it's got cooler side characters, a little more developed than the other ones, you know, with Tommy Jarvis, it's kind of, you know, it's interesting. They were kind of trying to like do this like arch nemesis of Jason type thing with him. And you never really got much characterization in the previous three films. So it's just cool to, I don't know. I feel like it gives the movie a little bit more weight when you're like, you don't want Tommy Jarvis's family to get murdered.
Right. And I do feel like the characters are really well drawn in this. And outside of, you know, Crispin Glover has never played a human in his life, I don't think. But the characters in this, like even, you know, the ones that you obviously know are just there to just get killed have character traits and they feel like real teenagers instead of like, you know.
Totally.
I think Joe Zito in the commentary said, you know, oh, other slasher movies, everybody looks like a Playmate centerfold. These look like real boys and girls.
Yep. Yeah, and they're like also they're kind of like nerdy, like they're striking out with the girls. It's not just like, you know, the typical, you know, it's not like there weren't like the more like stereotypical, like the jock and then like the rich kid and then like, you know, and then like the nerdy guys. Like they're all kind of like, you know, nerdy.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And I also just like those scenes where they're kind of like sitting around like just high watching stag movies and
smoking the smallest joint I think I've ever seen in my life. Yeah.
Yeah. I think he was a newbie. I don't think he quite knew how to do that yet. But yeah, actually it was something that I was thinking about because when I was watching the film last night again, that something Sam and I have talked about in the past with certain movies like this that have teenage casts. There's always that question of like, for example, when we talked about Night of the Demons back in October with Janet, my friend Janice, we talked about, do these kids actually know each other? Like they have a reason to hang out.
All seem to hate each other in that movie, you know?
Yeah. But I mean, in this film, it seems like there's a very clear reason why they're there. The question becomes why Crispin Glover and Teddy are there, really. They're the ones that don't quite fit. But I mean, obviously we get the impression that, I don't have the characters' names in front of me, but Samantha is dating the other guy. They're together. And then not Sarah, Samantha. Yeah, Samantha's dating the guy. Sarah is Samantha's best friend. And they're trying to hook her up with this other guy, this other friend. That is a very clear reason to go out to the lake and hang out. Like we're trying to set up our two friends. And we get the impression that at least those four have this connection. Teddy and Crispin Glover, I don't know, they just tag along.
Teddy has the weed, and you know, Kristen's Teddy's friend. I can see it.
And the computer, of course.
Nowadays, if you made this movie today, he would just run it through an iPhone app. He has the joking imaginary computer. Because of course at the time of this, like the idea that you'd have a computer that you could take with you would be absurd. Right. But yeah, it's a great scene, and allegedly that was improvised. That Teddy and Crispin Glover were improvising the whole dead fuck thing.
And I love that they keep coming back to it because like Crispin plays weird really well, but he also in this movie plays kind of like upset and offended really well. Like he just keeps, like Teddy keeps bringing it up and he's like, I told you I don't like it when you say that. I just don't.
Yeah.
And you can tell he's like, can you just stop, please?
He also seems like 100% convinced that it's actually a computer saying
He's like, what? That's what it says. What does it say?
Yes, he literally does do that. He says, wait, what does it say? I'm like, there was no computer. But I do like it. And of course it gets into his head. It's an actually interesting form of like friend bullying where it's so in his head that when he actually gets laid by a beautiful woman, he's still like, wait, was I good? You know,
and he's got his little ducky moment, you know, brings the panties down, which don't do that, guys. That's just weird.
Yeah. But I mean, I just love the idea that it gets into his head, you know, it's a very real reaction where like this guy keeps calling him dead fuck to the point that he actually literally now believes he must be bad in bed.
Right. And Teddy is the only person who gets like no play, you know, in this.
Yeah,
and he's the one going to him for advice, you know.
It's also interesting how they put the emphasis on fuck. It's like, I'm a dead fuck, right? Like he actually is a dead fuck because he gets killed.
Right, you know, they almost all are, you know.
Yeah
So what's everybody's favorite kill in this movie? Like we'll just dive into that. Which one really stands out?
You mean aside from Jason himself?
Yeah, I mean
because that's kind of
one early on that, I mean, this is more of like a very specific reason for me, but there's that hitchhiker who shows up towards the beginning and she gets like a spike through her throat while she's holding a banana.
Right.
And you know, the kill, it's not like clever or interesting really or anything, but like at the first time I watched this, I was in college and I had this really, really obnoxious student who was in a class who looked exactly like this woman.
And she had the side and everything.
Yeah. And watching this, I was like, me and my friend were watching, like, oh my God, that looks so much like what, I don't remember her name. So that, I don't know, that it's like very, like one of those very iconic sort of horror movie kills for me, because it just stuck in my head. And then also just showing her squeezing the banana after is like a bizarre.
Yeah, she got like little bits of it dripping out of her mouth.
Yeah,
aside the blood.
I think I read that she was actually, I don't know her name, but I think she was actually like a well-known actress, and they originally rejected the part.
Oh, really?
Because she didn't have any lines, but then she decided to do it anyway. Right. But I don't know.
That's actually one of my favorite Savini effects, because even though, you know, I've read his books and I've seen the, you know, how they did the effect, like when you're watching it, you still like can't figure out, your brain's trying to figure out how they managed to do that.
Right.
It still comes off as real.
Yeah.
For me, I think it's probably, I can't remember the gentleman's name, the guy that was killed in the shower. That's just so brutal with the just the smash. Sound effects and, you know, how they only used a couple of frames of, you know, the fake head getting smashed, but they, you know, do it all through acting and sound and just.
Yeah. Editing. And I was reading, because this production was apparently like super stressful and is very troubled, that the actor like actually got like smashed up against the wall and like really hurt himself during that scene. I guess Paramount had like first settled on an October release date and then just pushed it to April.
Right, because they're like, we have a Friday the 13th coming up. We need to put the movie there.
You know? Yeah, so they had like something like 6 weeks to like for post-production or something. Right. So I think they had to like rush and put a lot of actors in like, you know, pretty serious danger to get the movie finished in time.
Very much so. There's a story that Ted White tells. The actress who plays Samantha, she has to swim out to the raft to get, and she gets stabbed underneath the raft. She actually, the way they did that effect was that she's basically was completely submerged in the water the whole time, and she had a fake body behind her. And they kept being like, you can't come out. We have to keep shooting. We have to keep reloading the camera. And she's like turning blue. And apparently, I forgot his name. I just said it too.
Ed White.
Yeah. Basically says, you need to get her out of that water. It's really unsafe. And Joe Tocito's like, no, we have to keep doing it. And White threatened to walk off set if they didn't get her out. So they got her out, warmed her up. She ended up getting hypothermia and being sick for weeks afterwards. And a lot of the actors had talked about, you know, like it was 30, 32 degrees out, constant rain effects. They're all freezing. Everybody's really uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it made me like White a lot, because apparently like that was his call. Like he was like, you're going to have to do this without me.
That shows that he's a professional. He's a professional. He's a stunt performer. He's a stunt coordinator. Even if he's just, you know, playing just quote unquote playing, you know, the killer in this, like he still takes the responsibility for the safety of the, you know, the actors around him.
Yeah.
I guess he had a small run in with Tom Savini early on in production where Savini's telling him how we're going to frame the shot and everything. He's like, I'm a stunt performer. I know this. And, you know, Tom said, he's like, well, I actually do stunts too. And he's like, yeah, I've heard that about you, but anyways, we're going to do it this way. And I guess according to Tom Savini, who, you know, sometimes exaggerates slightly when telling stories, you know, he's like, everybody was gathered around him in the set expecting, you know, one of them to throw a punch at the other one at that point. And, you know, they're just like, that was the point where they decided, you know, oh, we could work together.
Yeah.
So, it turned into a mutual respect thing at that point. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I know Tom Savini worked on the first one. Did he not do the second and third one?
No.
He did not. No. He ended up doing The Burning instead of Friday the 13th 2. He was offered to, and then he decided to do The Burning instead.
And then he did The Prowler with Joe Zito as well.
Yeah, I think instead of 3. But apparently he was brought in after he was brought in later in the production of part 4. Originally went to another guy. And he backed out, so they called up Savini and said, we're doing we're doing the last one. We're going to kill Jason. And Savini was like, all right, I'm in, I created him, I'll destroy him. And he came in to do it. And of course, it's called The Final Chapter. Of course, there was another seven of these afterwards, but it was supposed to be the end. Obviously the ending of the film also was supposed to set up the idea that, Tommy Jarvis is going to be the new Jason, which apparently was seriously talked about.
Yeah, that's how it ends. Yeah, the content. I mean, we could discuss that more later, but continuity between, particularly these sequels 4, 5, and 6 are just like insane.
Which is, that's what I always refer to as peak Friday 13th is 4 through 6. But yeah, Savini said he didn't want to do the second one because he couldn't wrap his brain around Jason being the killer. He's like, he was dead in the first one.
It makes
no sense. It makes no sense.
Yeah. Even Chuck Cunningham. Sean Cunningham, not Chuck Cunningham. That's something else entirely. Sean Cunningham even said when they did Friday the 13th too, he's like, Jason's going to be the killer. And he's like, and that doesn't track in any way, shape or form if you try to think about it. So don't think about it.
Yeah, this was still early in the slasher genre where they, didn't realize that sequels didn't necessarily have to make that much sense.
What is what's the canon? Is it that Jason never really died and he lives out? He lived out in the lake, but witnessed his mom get murdered in the first one, and that's what
Yes,
according to Ginny's psychological theory in part two, I believe that's what it was. Yeah,
and then the remake kind
of played off as fact,
and then the remake does that. Well, the remake opens its film with young Jason apparently watching his mother get killed, which implies that apparently they thought he drowned, but instead he was living in the woods for a while, eating grubs or something.
Yeah.
And then he sees his mother get killed, rather than run out and be like, hey, mom, I'm not dead. You can probably stop killing everybody now.
And it's important to note that in these, especially these early Friday 13th movies, like we talked about with The Burning, there's a lot of urban legend kind of feel to these things where, it's more about the stories we tell around the campfire than actually,
Totally. Yeah.
Because even in this, Rob says he's out to avenge his sister. Well, his sister died yesterday.
Yeah.
How does he know this?
I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, three and four happened right after each other. So his sister would have got, if his sister was a character in part two, she would have died at most 3 or 4 days prior.
Right.
But the implication is he's been like, I'm out hunting Jason and I've been out here for weeks. And I'm like,
well, he's got all these different
time travel.
Yeah, he's got these different newspaper clippings.
What's the gap between one and two then?
About a year.
A year, okay. And it's two's not even at Crystal Lake, right? Isn't it a different campground?
Well, I mean, really, two is, because Crystal Lake is done-zo after the first one as a camp. This is on the other side of the lake, at like a training camp for counselors. And then three was at Higgins Havens, which was just like people hanging out in a cabin, and same thing with this one, as people living around the lake area.
He's just making his way back, I guess.
Crystal
Lake doesn't really come back into play until
six,
I think. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Six is the one where they've renamed the town.
Right. Forest Green.
Yeah.
Anyways, but let's talk about four. Keep getting sidetracked with trying to figure out the continuity of a series that was never meant to have continuity.
Well, I mean, what I love,
that's about, what we love.
The thing about this movie that it opens so strongly with that little recap,
right?
That I absolutely adore.
It's great.
Same.
The guy's like, tells the campfire story of Jason, intercut with all of the greatest hits, best kills of the last couple of movies, sets you up with a story. And then basically just cuts immediately, like Jason is actually dead, after the events of part three.
Or is he?
Or is
bum, bum, bum.
But then you get that great, you have this great like opening act of like the hospital bit, which it's like Halloween 2 for about 10 minutes.
Yeah, I was thinking that too when I was watching it recently.
And I always feel like I'm like, you could have made that a whole movie if you wanted to, but they didn't. I remember being struck by I think she actually is the only black character in the whole film. She's in the paramedic. She gets all these close-ups, and I'm like, I almost feel like she's supposed to be a major character.
Right.
They really kind of give her a lot of really like powerful close-ups.
Nope, just for the jump scare. Nope, yeah. Just go just home. For
the jump scare and go home. Yeah, she comes in, tells the mortician who's got, of course, he's got his donut.
Sandwich.
Yeah. Tells him he's a jerk and leaves, and that's it. That's how she is in the movie. And I'm like, okay, well, nice to see you and not know who you are. Like, you look like you were going to be important.
Yeah, they'll make like a spin-off movie eventually that explains what happened to that, character.
There's probably like three fan films with her in it at this point.
Yeah. So then he kills the mortician Axel after one of the most baffling sex scenes I think in horror film cinema, in horror film history. Why the nurse is down the clown with Axel in the first place is anybody's guess. But Axel then has one of my favorite things that I've ever heard said in a horror movie that doesn't make any sense. He says, "You're the Super Bowl of self-abuse," which it took me, must have taken me well over a decade to figure out what self-abuse meant. Because I think I took that literally as a kid. I was like, he abuses himself? Like, I don't understand that. And then he says, after Jason's hand comes out, he says, "Jesus Christmas. You know,
jumping Jesus Christmas shit."
Holy jumping Jesus Christmas shit.
It's a very Clark Griswold reaction in a lot of ways.
But he also says it like three times, I think. He doesn't like.
I guess there's a take of it where he just goes for like 2 minutes.
And
Wow, that's amazing. I still say that a lot if I stub my toe, like I'll just jump Jesus Christmas shit.
And then we go, so Jason wakes up, he kills Axel, he kills the nurse. And then he goes, that actress actually got hurt too in that scene.
Pin in the back of her head.
Yeah, she had like a hairpin or something and it went into her skull.
Right, because they smacked her against the wall that hard.
Yeah. You know? And that's when White was kind of like, I gotta chill out a little. Yeah. I'm getting a little too amped up. And then we have sort of two sets of characters. We've got
the Jarvis family, and then
the kids coming to the cabin.
And then we have the hitchhiker first, which, you know, A, we haven't had a kill in 30 seconds, we need another one. and B, it does help establish that, you know, he's returning, you know, he's going back to where he was, and this asshole was just there, you know.
There's also fun trivia, as the kids are driving, they stop at the graveyard and they see the headstone. It's when it's the actual revelation of how old Pamela Voorhees is and what her name is.
Right.
They never said that before.
Pamela Voorhees. No, they never said her first name was Pamela until this.
I think she just said I was Mrs. Voorhees.
Wow. So that established it. Yeah. And then it says, 1979 on the gravestone. So.
So she would have been just under 50 when she was killed. But this is a little fun trivia fact that Pamela Voorhees got her name on this film years and years later.
That's crazy.
So then of course we get introduced to Corey Feldman, and what as Sam mentioned, it wasn't his first film, but it was early.
He looks really young in this one.
And that's one of the things that struck me when I first watched this, because I was, well, this came out in like 84, so I probably watched it in 85 when I was probably right around Corey Feldman's age, or I felt like it, and that really, like, oh boy, you know?
Yeah.
This is happening to a kid who's, you know, I might go to school with, you know?
Yeah. I wonder if that was probably intentional to kind of...
Right. Because I would have been like 8 when it was on, you know, if I saw it like the next Halloween season or something, you know?
Yeah, but it is...
like 10 in this.
I mean, I guess it is the first Friday the 13th where there's a kid character, because, you know, notoriously there still has not been a Friday the 13th movie where it's just Jason like stalking like actual kid campers. It's always like the counselors
around. Or like even in 6, I mean, there's a point where you think he's going to start, you know, hitting the kids at camp, but he just kind of leaves them alone and goes somewhere else.
Yeah. Which makes sense. I mean, if, you know, you're Paramount, you don't want to make a movie where it's just kids getting slaughtered.
Right.
It was practically forbidden for many, many years. I mean, they got away with it in the 70s a little bit, and then it kind of, they were like, we're never doing this again.
Right.
And it wouldn't be until relatively recently that horror films started feeling comfortable enough to start having dead children again. It was definitely something that for probably a good 20 years, it just wasn't done. anymore. But so, I mean, even having a child actor in this film was probably already iffy territory.
Yeah, totally.
Well, the writer had said that he decided he for some reason, he wrote like every bad idea of casting into the script. He had a kid, he had a dog, he had twins. You know, he decided that these two houses needed to be right next to each other, and they ended up using one shot where you can see both houses in it. And they had to build a whole other house for the second house, the neighbor's house in this. So it's, you know, they're like, we need a shot with both of them in there, or else, you know, we're gonna get in trouble.
it's all
the rain and at night, you know, it's just
But Corey Feldman also just hit, like, his character kind of like spying on the older kids, and like when he runs into them like skinny dipping and stuff, it was like they were clearly trying to like market this towards kids without marketing it towards kids, you know?
It's it's a very powerful moment, I think, for most younger viewers who have, and that's the thing. I mean, like everybody's already said, like, well, kids don't watch horror movies, but almost every single horror fan in their 30s is like, I watched my first horror film at 10. These films got seen by kids all the time.
Yeah. And then, like, you know, a year after they came out, they would run on television in an edited form, but every Halloween you'd see, you know, how two or three Halloween movies played in a row on, you know, one of the UHF stations or a cable station. Every Friday the 13th is the same, you know. It's
But it's an establishing moment where he's gone to bed, Corey Feldman, and he wakes up and he sees across the way at the next house, two people, girls getting naked, they're making out, and he's just having this sort of like very childish sort of like hissy fit. Where he's like bouncing up and down, and he's like, "Oh my god, I'm seeing it,
boobs." He's reacting like a cartoon wolf at that scene.
He doesn't even know. He doesn't even know what he's really excited about, I don't think.
Right. Oh, I know. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And
definitely, I think that's not what to do with, you know, that metal image, obviously.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, my favorite part though is that after it's done, his mom comes in, so clearly sees knows what's going on, but then she gives him a kiss, and I'm like, hey, Tommy, congratulations for the years of therapy you're now going to need, because you're going to associate your mom's goodnight kiss with your first weird sexual experience. You're going to have boners, buddy.
Yeah. Or he'll associate it with, you know, Jason.
I was going to say, and then everything else happens, and he's got way more problems to deal with.
Bigger fish to fry at that point. Right. Yeah, but I'm like, Mom, the kid just probably may have just gotten his first little stir down there. Maybe kissing him right now is not a good
idea. But it also plays into like being a kid. Like, I mean, I haven't done that specifically because, you know, I haven't been in that situation. But, you know, you'd be doing stuff in bed that you're not supposed to be doing, like reading comic books or, you know, just fucking around, you know, playing with toys. And your parents come up and you're like, real quick, gotta act like I'm asleep.
Yeah.
And there, I think there was like an unspoken like rule between the two of you. As long as neither of you broke character, we're both going to pretend like you were asleep.
Right. Right.
One time I was jumping from my dresser onto the bed over and over again.
Oh, wow.
And I tried to pull that stunt, and they're like, we could hear you in the basement jumping onto your bed from the dresser.
Yeah.
This is too far. You pushed the line too far. We got to stop this.
But you're right. That is sort of, I think, the ritual, I think, is the parent has to accepts that you are pretending to be asleep, and we're not going to call attention to that.
Right.
And I mean, it does show that Mrs. Jarvis is probably a pretty cool mom. I mean, she pulls the shades down. Right. But you know, but she clearly is amused at the idea.
Yeah, that she put it all together pretty quick. She's not a dummy.
He was watching something you shouldn't see, and rather than freak out about it, she just shuts the blinds and says, "I'm gonna ignore that." You know.
Yeah.
Or they have the Jarvis sandwich, you know, which is an adorable little scene. You know?
Oh yeah.
I'm hungry for a Jarvis sandwich. He's like, no, not that.
It's weird that the mom does not look that much older than the daughter.
No,
the daughter almost plays the mom's role in this movie.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, she kind of turns into the mom, or almost like a Laurie Strode kind of character at the end.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, the actress, I forget her name, unfortunately.
Joan Freeman.
Joan Freeman.
She's born in 1942, so she would have been, you know, 41 when they filmed this, probably.
Well, I meant Trish.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
But yeah, the actress talked about like a lot of her work as an actor that she did for preparation was and became close with Corey Feldman, in particular because she knew that that's where the movie was going and that she needed to bring the energy of, I need to protect my younger brother. Mom just kind of gets bumped off. We don't see her again.
Right. Yeah.
And although there is a deleted scene, apparently a deleted final jump scare where Trish finds her mother's body. There's footage of it in the Crystal Lake Memories.
That was more of a dream sequence though, because Jason was there in the room with, you know, wakes up and she goes, it was kind of like Adrian King in the first movie where they have that dream sequence where Jason jumps out of the water. And they thought they had to do that for every movie. And they kind of dropped it here, which is good.
Which is great. Because even the first one stole it from Carrie. It's like note for note, the same exact thing.
Exactly. And the music, which is so, you know, iconic to the series and so important to the series, you know, I can't hear it half the time without thinking of, you know, how much it's like Psycho. And they admit.
Yeah.
But yeah, the scene, it does show, it has mom gets out, is in the bathtub dead, and she holds her in like her eyes open. They're all like white, milky.
Yeah.
I think it was a pretty striking visual.
Yeah.
But
it would have been one ending too many, because you really needed to end on Tommy, you know.
Right. Yeah, and suddenly suddenly it's Return of the King. Yeah.
Right.
There's, yeah. You know, six endings, but yeah.
And Jason went off to the Grey Havens.
Tommy ends up throwing out Worm
Saruman. Yeah.
Saruman. Yeah. Out of the Shire. But yeah. So I mean, yeah. The film progresses with mostly with the teens at that point. The teens are kind of hanging around. You know.
Well, since we had mentioned the mom's death, how do you guys feel about her death and the death of Rob are kind of not shown in such a fashion, you know, such a gruesome fashion as you know, a lot of the other kills. And I kind of feel like that was because these were characters we were supposed to like, and they wanted to save the gruesome kills for the fodder.
Yeah, it's like they wanted you to I think that's exactly what it is. Because you don't like really, I don't know, like I feel like you know when Crispin Glover gets killed, it's just kind of like, oh that guy.
Right.
but
Rob's kill, especially in the basement, aside from them going a little too far with the ADR, I mean, I think it's a really effective kill. Like, you just, it's all my
shadow.
Yeah, it's all in shadow. It's all just him reacting in terms of seeing, you know, Trish seeing like a little bit here and there. It's just the point where he starts yelling, "He's killing me," where I'm like, it's a little too much. He's killing me.
That's my favorite part of it. That's why it's my favorite death. That's why it's my favorite kill in the movie is him yelling, "He's killing me." I love that. I hope that when I die, and I don't care what I die of, if I'm like 97 and dying of old age in the bed, I want to yell out, "He's killing me!
He's killing me!"
Because technically something kills you, even if it's just natural causes. But you can just yell out,
"If I get a heart attack, I want to do the Bruce McCullough Kids in the Hollow thing where you yell at your heart to get back to work. But you know, if somebody's killing me, I'm going to yell that, you know.
Yeah, I always get a kick out of when in the slasher movie where someone just yells at the killer, like, "Leave me alone."
Right.
Just leave me alone.
Yeah. Leave us alone. And you expect the killer to be like, "Well, geez, no one's ever said that before." I'm gone.
What do I do here? You know?
Actually, there's a great moment where Jason has to, one of the very few times I think we see Jason really making decisions is actually Trish and Tommy are both on two opposite ends of it. And he looks between the two of them. Starts moving his head back and forth, and he's like, "I want to. Okay, I'm gonna go after the girl, instead of the kid,
because she just hit me with a TV. And what the fuck?
Trish becomes formidable pretty quickly.
Yeah.
In fact, the one of the things that works about Rob's death in particular is she runs away and then she comes back,
right?
Like she's gonna help him, which is a very final girl thing to do. She's like, "Well, I probably should go try to help him." But it realizes pretty quickly it's just too late. He's been torn apart.
Right.
And
up until that point, she's the only one who's, you know, put the hurt on him at all. Even, you know, Rob didn't even get a shot in or nothing. You know, he just
no.
he just screamed and died, which is what we would all do in these movies.
Yeah, and Rob, so Rob's looking for his sister, who is, I guess, one of the victims in part two.
Yes.
Right?
Yep.
Were there any other, like, was there any other connections to, like, the first couple movies after this? I mean, because, like, Tommy Jarvis sort of takes over the narrative from this point on.
Yeah, it becomes Tommy Jarvis's story for the next couple of movies.
Yeah, there's just, like, there's no more building of, like, the, you know, the Jason legend or whatever kind of.
No, even you know, the building it as an urban legend, really, after part six, they just kind of drop it. They don't even, you know, talk about him as an urban legend anymore. They kind of do a nod in Jason Goes to Manhattan, where the guy at the beginning scares his girlfriend with a Jason mask. And they do a lot of interesting world building in the probably the least regarded of the films, Jason Goes to Hell.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Where they have the whole town kind of reacting, and they have that diner that's doing 2-for-1 Jason burgers, that.
I really like Jason Goes to Hell.
I watched it recently, and I think the first time I was just disappointed that you don't really get that much, like,
Jason
action. But I like that one too. I just watched Jason X for the first time, like, somewhat like a year ago. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of shocked at how much I like that.
It's so much fun.
Yeah.
It's a fun movie. And so self-aware in a way that isn't obnoxious. Characters are, in Jason X, people are delivering their own one-liners.
It's okay. He just wanted his machete back.
This sucks on so many levels.
I think the problem with that, they marketed it with that dumb, like, I'm sure
post-screen kind of thing.
Yeah, but also just like the more like, you know, his mask looked completely different in all the marketing for it. Whereas, like, most of that movie, he's like, he just looks like Jason, Jason we all know and love. But
and the Uber Jason doesn't look
right
remarkably well to begin with, I don't think.
And I mean, historically, anytime a franchise goes to space, it's never a fun time. So,
or the most fun time, depending on how you want to look at it. As somebody who works with guys who actually make fun of bad movies. To me, those sometimes those are the most fun.
Absolutely.
We're gonna see Warwick Davis running around as Leprechaun in space. I'm like, I'm kind of all for that.
Yeah,
that's my kind of thing. But it becomes Tommy Jarvis's narrative for the next couple of films, and then but as far as like continued world building, it doesn't really happen.
Yeah, it kind of ends.
In fact, there are just actually more continuity errors than
color. Yeah, I mean, there's the whole internet pages, you know, dedicated to trying to figure out even like the timeline of when this all happens, and there's a lot of movies that happen in what would have then been the future that shouldn't have been, because they have everything has to take place on Friday the 13th after this, and it's just it's weird.
Yeah
part five actually brings up Jason's cremated,
right?
And then in part six, he's in a graveyard. So
yeah. Right.
It's sort of like who knows what's going on, or who knows
right what, you know? Well, because part four, I mean, he gets like completely hacked to pieces, but then part five, like I haven't watched part five in a little bit, but that starts with like this bizarre sort of intro where Tommy Jarvis is going to Jason's grave.
Right.
Is that a dream sequence, or is that just
part five is when Corey Feldman has a dream of Jason coming out of his grave.
Yeah.
To do that. That was like filmed in like Corey Feldman's backyard, because had the weekend off from doing Goonies, but that's neither here nor there. That's a dream. And then, he goes to that. And then part six, they kind of redo that, where a grown up Tommy Jarvis and Horseshack go and dig him up. Mm-hmm.
But how did he, who buried Jason, you know, like who paid for his headstone?
If you want to get dorky with it, I can tell you that in the novelization for part six, they do mention Elias Voorhees, Jason's father, is still alive, and he paid for it.
Oh, all right. There you go.
But if it's not on screen, it doesn't count. We all know that.
But yeah, Corey Feldman, I think, is supposedly the ending of the movie was supposed to be, and they were already talking about doing another, but that they wanted to call it the final chapter to be like, this is the end of Jason's story. Tommy becomes the new Jason. And then part five, apparently with some serious consideration to the idea of having Corey Feldman become the star of the franchise.
Right.
Now, I think Corey Feldman is the one that says that. So I don't know how.
The writer and the director of, because I watched the commentary track last night for this, and they both claimed that they had no ideas. No one told them anything about them continuing after this. As far as they knew, this was going to be the last one. But once the box office comes in, it's a moot point.
Right. And
this made more than anything, I think, any of the other ones at the box office. That took, less than a year for them to get another one out.
Yeah.
After saying this is,
I think there was probably someone at Paramount who was just like, all right, this slasher thing's kind of run its course.
Well, Paramount never liked the series to begin with, because they always wanted to be the respectable studio, quote unquote.
Yeah.
So they were kind of stuck in this, because they were trying to be known for like Oscar bait movies and these big respectable films, but they had this cash cow that's helping them pay for these Oscar movies, so they're kind of, I feel like it depended on who you talk to there. Like, some people probably liked it because it brought in money, and a lot of them just wanted to not be associated with it.
Yeah,
and it didn't help that Siskel and Ebert dragged these through the mud every time they came out. Rightfully so, but also to a degree which is just absurd.
Yeah, they did that a lot. And it kind of sucks back then, where I think a lot of people looked to movie critics like that to kind of form their own opinions.
Even myself, I feel like a lot of where I first started to realize that film was an art form that could be judged, or not so much judged but examined as more than just entertainment for an hour and a half, was watching Siskel and Ebert. But they would blast these films because they're not good films. If you're not into slasher films, they're not they're not Gone with the Wind. They're never gonna be. But then they would get like morally outraged about the fact that they exist, and it's like, come on, guys,
that's the problem. Because
you guys have been doing film for 30 years, you know that this has always been a thing.
But this, it's interesting that they decided to kill the franchise. And growing up going to the video store all the time, this was one of those posters you'd see, like Friday 13th, and it didn't say part four on it, just as Friday 13th, the final chapter, with the hockey mask and a knife in the hole, in the eye hole. And it's
there's the puddle of blood around it. I had that in my room growing up.
But it's so I remember just seeing that video all the time. It's like, oh, that must be like the eighth or ninth one or whatever. And then getting older and realizing it's like, oh, they were like going all in on this hockey mask, this iconic imagery. But there's only one movie before that he had the mask.
And only for half of just, it.
Yeah. Right.
So yeah, we haven't talked about, oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, no. Go ahead.
I interrupted you. We haven't talked about the greatest moment in this entire film, however. We have not talked about that yet. And that is Crispin Glover's dance.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. Sam, can you tell me the name of the song? Do you know it?
Love is a Lie by White Lion.
That's right.
I don't know if you guys have played the Friday the 13th video game.
We were actually talking about that before you came into the chat. Yeah.
The new one that you play online. Yeah.
Oh no, that one. No,
I think
I don't like playing games online, but I've played the single player mode on that. So I've played some.
Okay. Yeah. There's I'm pretty sure, I'm not positive, but I'm pretty sure that song there's a point in the game where it plays.
I do not doubt that.
Yeah. Like someone's playing it like on a boombox or something.
Right.
No way. Not today. No,
see, I grew up playing the LGN Nintendo version of that Friday the 13th, which was...
I've played that. That's a weird one, too. The game is actually... The new game is actually pretty... It's fun to play.
Yeah.
They show you, different eras of Jason, so you can play, Jason in part 3, Jason in part 6, or whatever.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
And one of the houses in the games is like a good recreation of the Jarvis house.
Yeah, there's all different settings too. So I'm pretty sure that Jarvis house is in it.
Which I just recently found out that house has been used in like a billion and a half movies.
Yes,
really.
And when Ron Swanson and the Parks and Rec people go out to Ron Swanson's cabin for hunting, that's the Jarvis house.
Huh.
Yeah. And like, because I was I was reading an article like, I don't know, about a month ago about the wildfire in California. And I'm like, they're like, oh, Topanga Canyon. And I'm like, why does that name sound familiar? So I go look it up and I'm like, oh, that's where the house from Friday the 13th part 4 is. And I look and it's like, it's just a million other things. Like, you know, Schwarzenegger movies have taken place. Yeah. Like Parks and Rec and this. And I'm like, why do I never make that connection? Even if I see the thing, you know?
Yeah.
I guess there's not like anything super recognizable. I don't know if you guys know the movie A Talking Cat.
Yes.
That's a movie like I just watched the riff tracks version of that.
Oh, recently. You know, Harry Manfredini went on to do the music for that. And a lot of
really
that guy's other films. Yeah, he did like the 13 series, did the music for all those.
13, yeah, someone's just telling me about all those. But that house, the house that's in A Talking Cat also appears in like millions of really, really low budget movies and like porn as well, because the director also does a lot of porn on the side.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the 13 are like a step removed from that. They're like,
yeah,
they're soft core. Then I guess this would be no core, because it's just like, right. It's sexy vampire boys, if I remember correctly.
But yeah, the Jarvis house, I don't remember. Like
the good news is the Jarvis house was not burned down in the recent fires, but in California, it's always a problem. Yeah. It always happened.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're running up on time. Any last thoughts on Friday the 13th before we ask Chris Gersbeck a little bit to kind of tell us a little bit more about himself, which we should have done at the beginning of the show?
I really like the version we get of Jason when he doesn't have his mask on in this one.
Yeah.
It's always like a little different, but this one, this one looks like it should be like a guy who's been living in the water for however many years.
Yeah.
Second one, he's more just like this weird hillbilly kind of killer. And then they show him in the third one too, but
yeah,
he looks kind of like hillbilly. Yeah.
It looks like The Hills Have Eyes, like remake.
Right.
Kind of hillbilly. Yeah.
And this one, he's kind of got he's still got like the weird googly eye, but he's all like all gray and stuff.
Right.
And I think they've recreated it a couple times since then, but I think this one holds up.
I mentioned that this kind of was a victory lap for Tom Savini, because this is when he, you know, really started to become, you know, a name amongst horror fans. Even more than he was after Dawn of the Dead. I mean, but this one's really like a victory lap for the whole franchise. And in a way, it kind of closed out the first cycle of slasher films, because after this is when Nightmare on Elm Street hit and then changed how these were made.
Yeah. And they also, I think, you know, Nightmare on Elm Street was a little more comical as well. There's a little bit more of like, you know, the Halloween movies are just like dead serious. And then, Nightmare on Elm Street, it's like a little more silly, and these, I feel like Friday the 13th, it's kind of like the perfect balance of like, it, you know, they're taking it seriously, it's not like super jokey, but it's also kind of scary. And that's, I don't know, I mean, Jason's always been my favorite.
And once the third act happens, and you know, it's he basically, when he kills Rob, I think the movie doesn't let up after that point. It becomes really you know, a thrill ride. It's stupid to say, but it's kind of like that. It's the tension keeps up after that, and it's
definitely,
like I said, it's the start of what I think is the best period in the franchise. It will be hard to ever beat if the franchise even comes back.
That's why I'm sure they'll do some kind of, I couldn't believe that the reboot came out in 2009. Like, that movie's already 12 years old, but I'm sure that they will do sort of like a retro kind of reboot and make it like sort of, I don't know, not, I don't want to say like a parody, but kind of like in on the joke a little bit more. I'm surprised someone hasn't done that already, because it's just so like,
well, it's spent like the last, you know, 10 years in, I mean, not 10 years, but it was last while in, you know, litigation. For the rights. If that ever gets wound up, I would not be surprised if they do a reboot or a vintage one, you know, just to to start it up again.
They'll do one like set in the 80s and license a bunch of really popular songs. And there was also like those rumors for a while that Quentin Tarantino was going to direct one, which I thought would have been amazing. But
I feel like Quentin Tarantino, if you ask him if he's going to do a movie, he's just like, yeah, sure. I'm working on that right now.
Yeah. And then they were going to do another Freddy versus Jason at some point too, I think.
Right.
It was talked about because that movie made a lot of money, but it didn't end up happening. But yeah, there was talk of like Freddy versus Jason versus Ash, trying to get Bruce Campbell in. And it ultimately just didn't really pan out, I guess.
Yeah. And now too much time has passed.
It's... Yeah. And Robert Englund's done with the character. And
And so is Bruce Campbell. I mean, I'm sure if you dropped a, you know, dump truck of money in front of his house, he'll do it. But otherwise, I feel like he's
I think Robert has said he would consider it. He would consider one more.
Right.
He's like 80 years old. So
71. Yeah.
Is he 71? Yeah. He's
I think so. I could be wrong.
I feel like he was 71 a couple of years ago.
And he was he was supposed to have been like, you know, in his 40s when he died. So it's hard to, it's harder and harder for him to come back into that role. I mean, it's just,
yeah.
What about you, Nathaniel? Any last thoughts on this before we?
Just want to reiterate that I love Sarah, and she's my favorite character in the whole movie, and I think they missed an opportunity to license when the guy's singing in the shower, he should have been singing, Sarah, by Starship. Missed an opportunity.
They wanted him originally to play like to sing an Elvis Presley song, and they're like, "Wait, that's not gonna work. That's gonna cost too much."
Yeah.
So they went with Tangerine.
But I think
was there a shower kill in part 3 that was like very similar to this one, or am I imagining that?
Was there a shower kill?
Not sure off the top of my head.
I don't.
Well, there's the guy who came out of the shower and was walking on his hands.
The headstand. That's what I was thinking of. Yeah. Right.
There was a head crush in part 3 as well, where the guy's eye popped out.
Yeah,
it came towards the camera because it was in 3D.
That's the only. I mean, that's the one reason. I mean, I think that's also why I would pick this one and say it's like the quintessential Jason movie because the third one's just so full of those like really dumb 3D gimmicks. Where you know, if you watch it, I've only watched it in like the red and blue 3D glasses. I mean, the effects are like every 5 seconds or something, but when you watch it without the 3D, it's just like, why is this guy pointing like
what? Yeah, why is the yo-yo in my face? What the hell?
It's just every kill has some kind of like thing pointed.
It's like it's like the SCTV 3D House of Beef sketch with John Candy. Nobody gets that. Okay,
I haven't seen that. I love SCTV, but I don't remember.
It was like Count Floyd used to have like 3D movies on his show, and they were all like the same kind of 3D effect where they'd be like, you know, you'd hear like the creepy sound effect and somebody would just be pushing something towards the camera and back again real slow, you know?
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, watching part 3 without the 3D is just, it's kind of like a baffling experience.
Right.
And I think they also, my buddy was telling me he bought the 3D version of that movie, and there was some kind of like manufacturing error that the movie actually wasn't in 3D, and they had to like recall the disc for anyone that bought it. So it's
I sent that disc back in myself for a replacement, even though I cannot see 3D physically. I want the right version, damn it. I paid for the right version. Sure.
I have a 3D TV. And I don't have like a Blu-ray player. I have an Xbox. I think we can play it on that. Yeah, a buddy of mine has like the newer transfer of part 3 that you can watch with like the real D 3D glasses. So I've never seen it like that. I'd like to check it out because I actually like the third one a lot more than I used to.
Every once in a while, they'll do like a showing at theater of the 3D version.
With 3D,
Yeah,
it'd be fun.
But anyways, tell us about yourself because we didn't give you a chance at the start to.
To plug. So I produced the Mads live streams, and the Mads are Trace Beaulieu and Frank Conniff from Mystery Science Theater. And it was about almost exactly a year ago we started doing these live streams where, you know, we just show a movie and two of them riff over it, and they've been really fun and successful and.
They're great to watch. They're fun as hell.
Thank you. Yeah, they are really fun, and they're so much fun to produce. And you know, everyone who's been watching them every month has just been awesome and very supportive. And the next one is Tuesday, July 13th at 8 p.m. And it's going to be the fourth night of shorts that we're doing. So it's going to be all educational shorts and cartoons and stuff. Yep. Nice. We're in the process of picking those out right now. And then Trace and Frank are going to start writing. And yeah, there's so much. Everyone seems to really like the shorts too. So
it's the shorts are always fun because if you don't like it, you're not locked into it. You know, you just wait 10 minutes and something else happens, you know?
Yeah. They're also just, I mean, they're so, I always liked watching sort of like educational stuff as a kid. Even like, you know, watching it from a perspective like, oh, this is so stupid, just because there's something about, I don't know, like people in the 60s and 70s trying to teach other people how to do stuff that I just find like really kind of comforting, but like also fascinating.
And they often did a really bad job with it. Like they're not usually good advice. It's
terrible advice. Yeah.
It's pretty remarkable. And then of course at the end of every show, they do a Q&A and you host that.
Yeah. So we've had, I think, and that actually happened not on purpose. I think the first show we did, when we did Glenn or Glenda last July, we didn't ever even, sorry, my cat's lying on my keyboard. We didn't even like, you know, we didn't know if we were going to keep doing it or what, but it didn't occur to us like, oh, we should have guests come on. And then we announced the Tingler and Victoria Price's daughter like emailed us and said, hey, I'd love to join you guys for this if you're up for it. And we're like, yeah, of course. And then
that was a cool episode. That was a cool get. Yeah,
that was great. Yeah, she was so awesome. And then the third one we did was Walk the Dark Street, and Jonah Ray had just emailed Frank and said like, hey, I'd love to stop by. And then that's when we were like, oh yeah, let's just book a guest every month. So Frank books all the guests actually. We've gone through like pretty much every original cast member and writer for Mystery Science Theater, except for Joel.
Yeah, so you haven't gotten Joel yet, have you?
Yeah, not Joel and Jim Mallon, but I don't think Jim Mallon would necessarily do it.
There might be some outcry from the Misties if I think.
Right.
Yeah.
But that was something I wanted to kind of point out to you is also like, you know, as started recording, I kind of said like, to me, you're kind of like a celebrity because I've seen you on my TV. Right. And you're connected with the Mads. But I mean, if the Misties are a deeply, deeply loyal bunch.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, if you're in with them, sky's the limit. They'll back you forever.
So. 100%. That's been the best experience of it, is just, you know, especially during a pandemic. I get emails like almost every day, people just like thanking us for doing these during a pandemic and it's what, like exactly the same thing for three of us too. It's, you know, especially Trace and Frank, they had all their tour dates got canceled. They had nothing, you know, going on. So it's just been amazing how much the fans have just come out and really supported them. And, you know, I saw Frank after he had his heart surgery a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. And I remember him telling me then that, you know, he's just like, my fans are just like the greatest, most supportive people in the world. Yeah. And, you know, of course I was like, oh yeah, of course you do. But now like seeing it firsthand, I'm like, oh yeah, you guys really are the greatest fans in the world. So
yeah. That's how Joel can raise, raised $7 million.
$7 or $8 million
for another season of Mystery Science Theater. Yeah, I mean, they'll come out.
And it's good for the fans too, because I mean, you know, as much, I don't want to take anything away from, you know, how much money that all these performers lost from all their shows being canceled, but like the people who go to those shows couldn't go either. It's like we were just all stuck in the house for a year and a half and like without any social, you know, experience with the people, you know.
One of the best experiences I've ever had with somebody that would be considered a celebrity was Frank and Trace. When I went to one of their live shows, they are so kind and so professional.
Oh yeah.
And it's great to see them still doing the Q&A because they do that at every show. But they had a rule where they were like, at the beginning of the show, they run their own merch table.
Yeah. Right.
Selling their own work. They'll sign anything you want signed. And they will take the time to make sure everybody gets their thing signed. But they say, don't take photos because at the end of the show, we'll make sure we take, and we will, if we have to stay for 3 hours, take a photo with everyone, we will. You don't see that kind of behavior from a lot of comedy performers or a lot of performers in general.
And that's super important to them. Yeah. Also that there's no, like, you don't have to pay an extra fee to then get to meet them or anything.
It's, right.
But just, that's why just to, the live streams have always just been $10 and no like real, there's no difference in like tickets or anything. It's just like, that's what it is. And, and yeah, it's been, you know, just the response has just been amazing.
So where can our listeners find tickets to the next match?
You can always go to themads.eventbrite.com. Mm-hmm. We put the tickets up at the end of each show for the next show. So, and if you buy a ticket, you get to download it as well. So even if you can't watch the live stream, you know, you'll get a file email.
That saved me a bunch of times because I work a lot of evenings. And
during,
during the week.
Yeah. And that was another thing we were like deciding when we were first putting it together. It's like, there's going to be a lot of people who aren't going to be able to watch this. And so, yeah, we knew we had to make, we had to have some kind of way to people to catch it, even if they couldn't watch it live. But yeah, I mean, that's, we are working on a way to sell past live streams for people that miss them. But for now, I mean, the best bet is to just buy a ticket as soon as you can. And so you don't forget about it. Right. And then if it gets emailed to you, then you, you know, you have it forever. So.
And they're on YouTube now too.
Right? Yeah. We launched the YouTube channel a few months ago. And little by little, we're putting up all the shorts that they've done over the past year. So right now we have all the shorts from the first night of shorts that we did back in October, and there's a bunch up there now since then. But that's the YouTube channel is youtube.com/themadsareback, and like and subscribe.
And where do they find you? Do you do any regular podcasting or any regular things besides that? Or
I before the pandemic, I was just producing and promoting live comedy. That completely changed, obviously. But I'm starting to book more, like, you know, as venues open up, we're starting to figure out how we can do more live shows again. So that's, you know, the past year has been an amazing experience. But I'm, you know, excited to like get out there and produce live comedy like for an audience, and so it's my company's Dumb Industries, and so that's kind of like the banner that I use for anything that I produce or promote. So you can go to dumb-industries.com and all the stuff that I work on is on there.
Awesome. I hope people do that, and I'll definitely do that. So Chris Gersbeck, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks, man.
It's been
This was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's been a very good time, and I'm so glad I took the shot and like, this famous guy's gonna tell me no. Thank you so much for being here and having this conversation.
Of course, yeah, I can't wait to listen to it.
And please come back anytime, you know.
Yeah, anytime. Oh yeah. If you guys ever want to do any other Jasons, I mean, I'm available.
We'll definitely do that. Well, then you're now our Jason go-to guy. So
All right.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Chris Gersbeck.
Thank you.
And as always, we like to remind everybody to love yourself and love your fellow horror fans. Keep it positive, keep it constructive, and stay safe. It's still a tough world out there. If you haven't been vaccinated, go get vaccinated, so that you can go to one of Chris Gersbeck's produced comedy shows.
Yes.
I check out the Mads. Obviously Sam and I are both Dyed in the Wool Misties, so that's exciting. With that, we say thank you for listening, and thank you very much. Good night and namaste.